Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Dr. Kiki's Science Hour is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Dr. Kiki's Science Hour with Dr. Kiki Sanford and Leo Laporte, episode number 32 for Friday, January 29th, 2010, Decline of the Dinos. Hello, everybody. This is Dr. Kiki, and this is Dr. Kiki's Science Hour, episode number 32. We are talking about the decline of dinosaurs. And Leo and I have a special interest in this. Leo, coming from a paleontological family, and myself, I just like dinosaurs.
Does that mean we're full of rocks?
That's right.
Paleontology is the study of fossils. Is that right?
The study of fossils, exactly. And when I'm talking about the decline of dinosaurs, I'm not actually talking about their extinction. A recent study took a look at a group of dinosaurs called dome-headed dinosaurs or pachycephalosaurs and concluded that possibly up to one-third of classified dinosaur species could be eliminated, that mistakes have been made in classification. And so with us today to talk about classifying dinosaurs, dinosaur fossils, and all things good and dirty and paleontology related is Dr. Mark Goodwin, who is an assistant director at the UC Museum of Paleontology at UC Berkeley. So, Mark, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Now, in one of the descriptions of what you do, I love going back and forth between the academic language and describing things for the lay person. The description is that your field and laboratory research is focused on Upper Cretaceous faunas of the Western Interior and the Mesozoic of Ethiopia. Current research projects include studies of pachycephalosaur cranial morphology, histology, and behavior, ontogeny and cranial variation in Triceratops, stable isotope biogeochemistry of Cretaceous and Tertiary faunas, the effect of the burial environment on the stable isotope biogeochemistry of fossil bone and teeth, Eocene marine mammals from Israel and their biostratigraphic significance. It's a lot of big words in there. So in a few less academic words, could you describe your research interests for us?
Sure. My research basically is on dinosaurs and the animals they lived with and the environments that we find them in. Because when we're out in the field, we look at the geology and that gives us clues to the paleo environment, what the region was like when these animals were alive. And as a paleontologist, that's how I think about these animals. Not only how they acted when they were alive, what their behavior was like, why they were so successful. One of the most successful groups of vertebrates ever to walk on the planet. So as my friend and colleague Jack Horner always says, he goes, I really don't care why they went extinct. I'm more interested in knowing how they lived and why they were so successful as a group, so diverse.
I think a lot of people who are listening are saying, wait a minute, these dinosaurs were successful?
Yeah, all we know about is the fact they all died.
Yeah.
in a sense, it's sort of a mistaken extinction. They really didn't go extinct. You know, most of us that in November have a very large dinner at Thanksgiving with a turkey in the middle of the table, and birds are the lineal descendants of dinosaurs. We see a lot of shared characters between birds and dinosaurs, and that's probably another subject of.
Yeah, I'm a huge bird fan, and so I love to be able to look at birds on an electrical wire or picking up little seeds or crumbs near the restaurant table where I'm dining, and just think of the little dinosaurs that are hanging out around me. I think that's very.
And we look at them to give us an idea about dinosaur behavior, because. Mm-hmm. You can arm wave, as paleontologists are known for, and describing these ideas about how these dinosaurs walked and how they acted and interacted between each other and with their neighbors, if you will. But you have to look at modern animals that are closely related, and that would be crocodilians and birds today.
Now, when you talk about the environment and how successful, what the world that dinosaurs lived in the particular era, the Cretaceous era that and Mesozoic eras that you look at, what was the world like? What kind of an environment were the dinosaurs that you study behaving in? What were they doing?
Sure. Well, the dinosaurs I study primarily from the late Cretaceous, sort of the end of the age of dinosaurs, if you will. And here we are, you can picture the eastern plains of Montana. Mm. You're currently about 150 miles east of the Rocky Mountains. It's flat, it's hot, and it's dry. And the dominant, you know, vertebrate animal is besides humans, are cows. But 70, 80 million years ago, it was a very warm, a very wet area. The Rocky Mountains were just forming to the west. You had a series of braided streams and rivers flowing from these highlands down to a large inland sea that actually bisected the North American continent in half, if you will. So from the Gulf of Mexico all the way to the Arctic Circle, you had this large inland seaway, and along its eastern and western margins being Montana and North Dakota and Wyoming and the western interior, it was a great place to live. Mm. And the right rocks exposed today that buried these animals shortly after they died. And as a paleontologist, that's, you know, summer's the best time to go out and walk up and down these badlands looking for bones that are weathering out of the ground.
So you just wander around and look for bones sticking out of the rocks?
I wish it was that easy. I say that because we don't do a lot of digging at first. We do a lot of walking, mm-hmm. and we call it prospecting. And because as bones weather out through seasonal rains and through erosion and snow melt, and, you know, on an annual basis, those are the clues on the surface that tell us what may be beneath the surface. So we look for these bones, or float, actually called float, that collects in little drainages. You can picture these badlands, very little vegetation, rolling hills and canyons and sometimes steep terraces and rock faces. So it's a lot of up and down, and it's often very hot. Mm-hmm. So you're hoping you'll find something, you know, early in the day so you can stop walking.
Right.
And that's when we take out the little tools and brushes and what have you. You expose more of the bones.
Right. And when you're looking at the bones, is when you find them, you excavate them, you bring them back to look at them. What has happened to the bones? I mean, you're talking about all the weathering, all of the environmental processes that happen around these bones. I mean, they've been encased in rocks for years. The bones have changed. How much does the environment actually impact these bones?
No, that's a really good question. And I've been interested since I was a kid in fossils and dinosaurs and how the bones are preserved. And I have to say, in the last 20 years, there's been sort of a revolution using bones as the source for various types of analyses that reveal what the chemistry is. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people have this notion when you go into a museum and you see a dinosaur skeleton or fossil crocodile or turtle on exhibit, people go, well, of course, that's a dinosaur, but those aren't the real bones. No, I mean, unless it's a reproduction, those are the real bones. And what's the dominant, you know, element, mineral in our bones? The dominant
calcium
and phosphorus.
Phosphate, right.
And the dominant minerals in this bone, in this little triceratops horn, are calcium and phosphorus. The difference between this and modern bone is it's been enriched significantly in iron and manganese. And simply that's one of the major, major differences between this, besides if this animal doesn't live anymore.
Right. But it becomes much more like a rock. I mean, I think of rocks as containing iron, as containing these metals.
Right. So chemically it's altered.
Yeah.
And I'm very interested in what the effect of the burial environment is on that process. For instance, how long it takes. We really don't know how long. Is fossilization something that occurs in tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of years?
Mm-hmm.
And why is this even important, you might ask? Well, it's important because scientists such as myself and biogeochemists and geologists will use the chemistry to interpret the environments these animals lived in. They'll even use it to try to figure out what they ate. And if what we're measuring is a byproduct of the burial environment, then that may not be the best way to test various hypotheses about, you know, behavior or paleoecology or the physiology of these animals or their diet. So it's very, very important. It's gone. It's not just that simple, you know, that diagram you still see in a lot of high school and college textbooks with little round objects going into a bone, these molecules going in and molecules going out. It's much more complex. And we're trying to both quantify and qualify or describe what the differences are between between modern bone and a fossil.
And it seems like that would be really difficult, that there would be a lot of issues with trying to tease apart different environments, different time scales, different, you know, what processes were actually occurring to the bone during life versus stuff that happened after the bones were laid down as a fossil.
Exactly. It is difficult. And it takes a lot of time.
Yeah. How do you actually classify, how do you quantify these things?
How do you quantify them? Well, a variety of methods and analyses, and it's a collaborative endeavor. I work side by side with physicists and chemists and geologists and sedimentologists and biologists and evolutionary biologists, of course, and other paleontologists to get this information. And for instance, there's a number of, right on the Berkeley campus, up on the hill at Lawrence Berkeley Lab, there's a huge synchrotron at the advanced light source. And it uses X-rays at different wavelengths to interrogate these very small areas of a fossil bone. And through this interrogation, we can actually determine what elements are present. And we can map these elements really at the molecular level and at the micron scale to see how they're distributed in a bone. And then we can look at the sort of chemical makeup of fossils and see how it varies and try to determine what that means.
I love the integration that bringing in nuclear physics into studying these fossils, taking it down to that micron scale and trying to see what kind of a fine resolution that you can actually get is as the technology is advancing. Are you finding that you're able to get more information out of a bone?
Both. We can get more information out of the bone and these new techniques and analyses, you know, basically they've increased the resolution, if you will, of what we can recover. I mean, back in the 60s, the most sophisticated, you know, transmission electron microscopes would give you a backscatter image showing you a bunch of bright spots indicating there was a lot of iron or manganese in the bone, but it wasn't mapped. It didn't tell you how much iron or manganese was there. It didn't tell you if it was concentrated in the virgin bone around what used to be a blood vessel versus the surrounding tissue. So we're increasing the resolution of analyses, and we're also increasing the resolution of sampling now as well with very fine drills and lasers. And there's a whole, you know, generation of new generation of equipment and expertise that we can tap into. And I'm finding that very exciting.
I think it's exciting, and the addition of lasers to anything is always exciting. When the classification of these things, I mean, you're talking, the technology is now allowing you to get down into this microscopic scale and sub-microscopic scale even. the classification of dinosaurs used to be gross morphology, so physical traits that you could look at. There's a bump on the bone here. There's not a bump on this other skull bone over here. So these have to be different species. How is it turning the paleontology world over to be able to have these new techniques? I mean, are you having to just go back and do everything over again?
No. Well, I mean, we don't do everything over. But, you know, we build on the past, on what was done previously, if you will. Classification of, I mean, we're talking about dinosaurs and you know, how that's done, you know, in a sense, sort of like making sausage. It's, you know, something, you know, you may not want to see it, but you want to see, you know, the end results. It is a lot of looking and selecting characters from the bone, like you said, a bump or a particular suture arrangement between individual bones. But the side effect, if you will, of being able to get a better handle, let's say, on the relative age of these mm-hmm. individual dinosaurs, combine that with getting a much better handle on the comparative morphology of their skulls is now cluing us into, oh, hold on a second. They appear, like, particularly with Triceratops and Pachycephalosaurs or dome-headed dinosaurs. And we're finding it in a lot of other dinosaur families as well. They go through this extreme burst, this burst of extreme changes and how they look. And we're able to document that. That's why field work is so important. Because people say, well, why do you keep going to Montana? Don't you have enough Triceratops fossils? Well, Triceratops has been known for over 100 years when the first skull was described. The problem is, you know, back in the day, back in the late 1800s, early 1900s, bigger was better. So they went after the largest skulls they could find. And the collections in museums today, which we study, are skewed towards adult individuals. So what do teenagers look like? What do young juveniles look like? Well, we have demonstrated they look very, very different. So different that in many cases they were previously named as different species of dinosaurs.
What was it with the studies that you've been working on with Jack Horner, going back and looking at these different sized creatures, the organisms having different traits that were once like you're saying, once considered separate species, completely separate species. Now you're saying they're just different life stages, different developmental stages of the same animal or same organism. What was it about technology that's allowed you to make this reanalysis, this new classification basis?
Well, there's a couple of different areas. One is histology, where it doesn't just pertain to modern tissues. We can use histological techniques where basically we cut a fossil, or we take a very small sample from a fossil bone or tooth, and we attach it to a glass slide, and we grind it down really thin. Thus, it's called a thin section. We can pass light through it, magnify it through a microscope, and we can look at the very fine architecture, if you will, the fine details that are revealed in the thin section. And bone is a dynamic tissue. I mean, any of us, when we were kids, that fell off our bike and broke our clavicle or broke an arm or an ankle, right?
I did that, yeah. Trampoline accident.
And you wore that cast for a while and all your friends signed it, and then then it healed. And how did it heal? How does that happen? Well, bone is a dynamic tissue. Mm-hmm. It responds to stress. It changes. Biomineralization is a very complex series of events that people are, you know, still studying mm-hmm. for a variety of medical and biological and evolutionary sort of trying to get it at different processes. But we can identify tissue that we would classify represents a very young, fast-growing individual, very porous, has lots of holes in it, lots of blood vessels, very spongy. And you look at that same bone, let's say from the skull of an adult, and you show that picture of those pachycephalosaurs, like one there, you see that dome has popped up in the middle of the skull and has really long horns on the back. Well, there was a skull that looks just like that called Dracorex. It was described as a new genus of dinosaur. And it looks basically the same, except it's flat. And if the dome is highly variable, right, affected by growth and the age of the dinosaur, then that's probably not a good character to define or diagnose your dinosaur genus.
Right. The Dracorex, the name I love, and I think there are a few people who are saddened to possibly see this species name disappear into the larger species name.
Well, we would argue it's not a valid taxon, but it does represent a unique morphology, and it's a unique morphology not because it's a different genus. It's a unique morphology because it's a very young stage of growth. So we can look at it histologically, and then we can look at it on a gross scale with Dracorex, the cast, the white skull there on the end of the table. And you can see it has lots of bumps and nodes and horns on the back. And if you just pop a dome up in the middle of that skull, you have another morph that's been known as a dinosaur called Stygimoloch, which we have here at Berkeley. It's an art type collection. So not only did we have to sink one of Robert Bakker's dinosaur species, we had to sink one of our own here at Berkeley as well. But, you know, these are names that scientists use to communicate with each other. So in a sense, you know, they're not lost. They do become part of the permanent record of nomenclature for these groups. And it reflects how different scientists reinterpreted the same fossils. And that's how our science proceeds. Yeah. And, you know, in 30 or 40 years from now, there'll be other scientists that take a look at these same fossils and likely reinterpret them again as more is known.
It seems interesting that the dinosaurs that you're talking about have these pretty dramatic physical traits. So that's the difference between not having a dome and having this huge dome, or with Triceratops having having a frill, or any number of dinosaurs that have any kind of very dramatic physical trait, I think, would fit into this possible category of having been over divided. When Jack Horner said that it's possible that maybe a third of all dinosaur species have been misclassified, do you think that's accurate, or is it a third of these species that have these really dramatic traits?
Well, I guess only future work will bear that out, that percentage. I mean, we did it with Pachycephalosaurs. We had three, and we reduced that to one taxon. But I think we're seeing this trend. That also supports our hypothesis. And it's very easily falsifiable because, let's say for these dome-headed dinosaurs or Pachycephalosaurs, you find a flat-headed skull with adult tissue or adult histological profile, then we have to reevaluate our hypothesis. If you find an adult Triceratops with its horns,
that's illustrating a domed baby head, I believe.
That's right.
Yes.
Well, that, we put that in to show the sutures are open, very open at early stages. All this on that histology slide from the Pachycephalosaur, and that's the other thing. We have multiple lines of evidence. You know, and I always say, just because an animal looks like it does something, it doesn't mean it did. And with multiple lines of evidence from the macro or gross morphology, from the micro scale, micron level histology and morphology, where we find these bones in the fossil record, and seeing it in a number of, you know, all the major families of ornithischian dinosaurs, whether it's Ansariscians as well, whether it's in Tyrannosaurids, in duck-billed dinosaurs or hadrosaurs, and Pachycephalosaurs and horned dinosaurs. I mean, I think the very cool thing is we're documenting for the first time the growth series in many of these groups of dinosaurs. And it builds on work that was actually done in the 1970s by a vertebrate paleontologist, P. Peter Dotson, who's at the University of Pennsylvania, who recognized these trends in hadrosaurs or duck-billed dinosaurs. But only with our increased field work and finding more records of these fossils were we able to recognize these growth series and these trends. And, you know, even when I even had a little problem getting my head wrapped around the idea of with pachycephalosaurs, you can see right behind me there, that big gray skull is pachycephalosaurus. And Stegomoloch that had the little dome and the really long horns on the back of its skull, well, those horns get smaller. And you can see they're color-coded in yellow and blue, and they're actually reduced in size. But at the same time, the dome gets really massive and highly inflated. And then in the oldest individuals, we see that the dome actually, again, gets somewhat reduced and a little flatter and wider. Uh-huh. And the morphology actually gets a little gnarly in old age. And, I mean, you know, you think about it when we, unlike birds where you can, you know, birds oftentimes distinguish males from females based on color.
Yep.
And the feathers, not from their bones, what we right. call sexual dimorphism. Some animals do this, you know, the females are either larger or smaller than the males. But in the fossil record, you need a very large assemblage of the same species from one area to test a hypothesis. And that's all we're doing. We're testing these ideas or hypotheses of sexual dimorphism. Mm-hmm. And it's pretty well documented that dinosaurs, only a few groups mildly express any sexual dimorphism in the skeleton.
So with these pachycephalosaurs, you're basically looking at them and it's differences between young, juvenile, and an adult, but not young females, young males, juvenile females, juvenile males. So you don't end up with six different...
can't distinguish them.
You can't distinguish them.
Yeah, at least we can't adequately test that hypothesis with the fossil record we have. But given the evidence that we do have, it seems like all adult Triceratops have large horns, and all adult Pachycephalosaurus individuals have a big dome and reduced ornamentation. In the past, there have been some earlier studies that attempted to differentiate males from females with Pachycephalosaurus, but they confused juveniles in their mm-hmm. sample set. And actually, what they were looking at was the juvenile condition of having a shelf and a smaller dome. And on the other hand, it's just remarkable to find like that baby Triceratops skull fits on a dinner plate. Probably was somebody's dinner.
Probably was. The Triceratops, I think, are interesting. I'd heard some ideas, some hypotheses bounced around a few years ago. People were writing about the idea that the frills, the different stages of frills that maybe now were just different levels of just age development during life, that they were sexually dimorphic. So females having smaller frills maybe, or frills with holes in them that were different from the way that the males were presenting. Is that possible, or are you with the Triceratops, is that just young versus old?
Well, no, you raised some earlier studies, some observations that people had made that both with the horns, looking at the morphology of the horns, saying these different shaped horns represented females, the ones that curved a little back, and the males curved a little forward, with the frill as well. And we see this in the Hell Creek Formation in eastern Montana with a dinosaur called Torosaurus. And a graduate student from Montana State, John Scanella, whose committee I'm on, Jack Horner's student, had looked at Torosaurus. Basically, Jack gave him the challenge to falsify the hypothesis that Torosaurus is not Triceratops.
Right.
And as you...
That's an interesting question to put forward, to falsify that it's not Triceratops.
That it's not Triceratops.
Yeah.
It's really big. And with this wonderful collection of juvenile and very young and subadult Triceratops and shown in a reconstruction view there in that animation series. Torosaurus is very large. Mm-hmm. We don't see any juveniles or subadults necessarily that reflect the morphology of Torosaurus. If you look at how it's diagnosed or how it's defined on these characters that are largely affected by ontogeny. Mm-hmm. And John, who has a paper who reported on this at the Society of Vertebrate Paleontology meetings in September in Bristol and has a paper in press in the Journal of Vertebrate Paleontology, has shown, in fact, we found it here on that adult skull that you showed a little while ago in the biosciences library on campus here, that we can see the thinning that's occurring on the frill. There are two large round areas. It looks like somebody took a tennis racket and just pressed it down into wet cement. Hmm. And frill, that's a very large adult. That skull is over 6 feet long.
Yeah.
But Torosaurus, these dinosaurs grew throughout their life. There are Triceratops and Torosaurus skulls with the Torosaurus morphology that are, upwards of close to, 9 feet.
Wow.
In
huge.
Length.
Man.
But we begin to see this thinning occurring in this fenestra forming, this hole, fenestra, in the frill. And it sort of makes sense from a biological point of view that Torosaurus is known in relatively fewer numbers in the fossil record. And there's an adult Pachycephalosaurus skull, and you can see it's all filled in and nearly solid. That's one of the characteristics of an advanced stage of growth in a dome-headed dinosaur. So with Torosaurus, again, it's rare in the fossil record. And, if you look at the normal distribution of fossils of dinosaurs, the youngest and smallest and the oldest and largest are not represented in the same numbers, sort of the mean or median size of the population.
Right.
But with intense collecting and collecting everything and not just,
not just the big ones.
Not just the big ones.
Right. Not just the ones that are going to look really pretty on the museum floor.
Exactly. we've also observed that there's a geological influence, a facies influence, if you will, on where younger Triceratops are found in the Hell Creek Formation. And those rocks, because when the bones weather out of a mudstone, mudstones are basically defined because the grains of clay are very small compared to sand. And that's how a geologist defines what kind of rock you're looking at. If it's a sandstone, you can see the grains. If it's a siltstone, you can't see them. But if you put a piece in your mouth and chew it between your teeth, it's gritty. If it's a mudstone, you do that, it doesn't taste like anything. Okay? So what happens when you're walking in the mud on a rainy day for out-of-point rays? You're slipping and sliding all over. That mud swells up, and there are clay particles in there that swell up and gets really slippery. Well, if you're a fossil bone and you're weathering out of that clay and it swells, what do you think happens to the fossil? Breaks apart.
Yeah.
To a greater degree than if it was buried in a sandstone. And then when the rain, that summer storm passes and it gets to 90 degrees the next day, it gets hot and the soil dries out, what happens? Shrinks. So that bone goes through this cycle of expanding in the rain, shrinking when it's dry.
Mm-hmm.
So as it weathers out, it's just this, surface covered with, hundreds or thousands of bone fragments. And most paleontologists, I think we've demonstrated, just kept walking.
That's going to be a mess. That's going to be a lot of work.
Not worth collecting.
Yeah.
If you're fortunate to have a lot of graduate students with you in a crew that
now
you can,
we know what they're for.
Uh-huh.
They're younger.
Grunt
they're
work.
Stronger, and they're good with a pick and shovel. But seriously, if you dig into the hillside quite a ways, both in and laterally, and that's what we call, removing the overburden that's covering that layer of really weathered, crappy-looking bone fragments, what we've demonstrated is that the bone deeper in is actually in great shape, and it goes together beautifully. Mm-hmm. And this is an example. This is the squamosal bone of a teenage triceratops.
And you just happen to have it lying around.
I'm overdue to on a paper describing it. It should have been submitted last month, but you know, to a paleontologist, what's 30 days, right?
I mean, right.
It's due sometime in the Mesozoic, and we'll leave it at that.
Right. But the point is that there seems to be a historical bias complicated by these taphonomic factors, if you will, or geologic factors or facies that is responsible up till now with our collections, here at Berkeley and at the Museum of the Rockies in Montana State that Jack and his crews have amassed. Now we can see when we hit the mudstones and collect in the mudstones, we have this great assemblage of subadult and juvenile and even baby triceratops.
That's cool. So you're finding more of them, and they're going to allow that increase. They're going to allow you to increase the sample set. So you're going to have more to compare against.
Well, right. We have increased the sample size, and you know, on the other end of the spectrum, you have if you're a vertebrate paleontologist and you work in Montana and you want to go find an adult dinosaur or a really good dinosaur skeleton, you look in the sandstone. I mean, this is just conventional wisdom because the bones are not as distorted.
As with the mud. Considering the distortion and going back to the histology or the actual tissue level analysis of these bones, with the mud, I mean, and the expansion and the contracting and the bones themselves are shattering or breaking over the millions of years that they're in the earth. I mean, what does that look like on the histological level? Is there any, what kind of organic material is left over by the time you get your hands on these pieces? Is there any kind of any soft tissue left at all inside the bones, or is it just all dry?
No, I mean, surprisingly, you may be familiar with Mary Schweitzer's work. She was Jack Horner's graduate student. Mary's a professor at North Carolina State now in Raleigh. And seven, eight, 9 years ago, she inadvertently, or a technician inadvertently, left a piece of a T-Rex femur in EDTA, which is an acronym for a multisyllabic long, you know.
It's a sodium, I don't remember.
It's an acid.
Yeah, I've used it.
It will mineralize the bone.
Mm-hmm.
And what her technician found after leaving it in too long were these three-dimensional vessel-looking structures. And in those vessel-looking structures were these round, nucleated, reddish objects. Now,
blood cells.
Well,
maybe
they look like blood cells.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, the question is, just like a dinosaur, a T-Rex femur looks like a modern femur, but it's been altered.
Mm-hmm.
So the question what Mary and her students and myself were trying to figure out, both not only what is it, but what is it altered to and how is it altered? When you ask the question about when you look at these histological slides, you know, we see evidence of bacterial infiltration on some, but we don't know when that necessarily occurred. You can only imagine an animal dies and decays. But I think what we're beginning to realize is that fossilization is actually a preservational process. Okay? Mm-hmm. Now, if you deal with younger, let's say, you know, mammals that are, you know, fossil mammals, 10 or 12 million years old, I do this work, other scientists do this work. We take a little bit of their enamel powder and we dissolve it in phosphoric acid, and it gives off carbon monoxide, and we pull off the carbon molecules and the oxygen molecules. We run that gas through a mass spectrometer, mm-hmm, that measures and compares the mass, if you will, of those molecules.
Yeah.
And we can distinguish them and measure them compared to a standard. And basically, we get an isotopic signal. It's a number. And that number would reflect what kind of water it was drinking, what type of plants it was eating. But the inherent assumption to these studies is that those are the original molecules of oxygen that were incorporated into that mineral matrix mm-hmm. when the bone or tooth was formed. Now, with carbon, there's not a lot of, you know, inputs for carbon. The main source of carbon is food. There's that right. saying, you are what you eat, give or take two per mil. I mean, you know, if I get a sample of your hair or your teeth, I could pretty much give you a very close approximation where you grew up.
I've been trying for years to, I would give up. Just kidding.
And you know, there's a whole field of forensic, you know, geochemistry, and that tries to answer a lot of these questions. But nonetheless, trying to answer questions about paleoecology, paleobiology, paleoclimate, physiology, even with dinosaurs, what kind of physiology? People look at their oxygen isotopes that are recovered from their bones. Well, I've asked the question, how can you tell if those oxygen molecules are from the burial environment, that there's been this diagenetic alteration, yeah. or they're actually the original molecules incorporated into the bone? So we're doing a whole slew of experiments looking at bones from different environments, marine animals and terrestrial vertebrates like dinosaurs and marine reptiles buried in the same marine sediments, and seeing if their mm-hmm. chemistry is different.
Right.
And compared to dinosaurs from buried in terrestrial sediments. So we're doing the same thing with tertiary mammal fossils. We're getting some very interesting results that we're getting close to submitting for publication. And you know,
I said, I can't wait to hear what the results are.
Well, basically, you know, we want to bring something to the table that just doesn't say, you know, mm-hmm. your previous methods of sampling were not good. We want to say your previous methods of sampling may have had some shortcomings, but here's how we can further test and maybe improve.
Right.
That.
As opposed to just making the assumption that all of the oxygen came from the course over the course of development when the bone or tooth or whatever formed, we can now say specifically whether it came from the environment or, you know, we don't make the assumption anymore. You do the science to actually figure out part of the environment it came from.
Right, because I think it's incorrect. The problem is if you know, a lot of people, you know, make the assumption that the bones are not altered.
Yeah, but they're being altered all the time.
In life and in
death.
You're absolutely right.
We had some questions. I put it forward to Twitter and people out in the social media sphere to ask some questions about dinosaurs. So I have a few questions from people, and I don't know, Leo, can we do Tawakin, or is that, I don't know if that's difficult.
It's too late to do
okay,
it at this
then
point,
we will not
it's already
do it.
Four, so,
okay.
Yeah.
No problemo. Didn't know if you had it on or not. So.
I didn't. And thanks for reminding me. I'll do it from now on.
Okay,
worked really well yesterday. So yeah.
Not a problem. All right. So we have some questions. Yeah. The basic question, which we've kind of been talking about from Freak DG. How can scientists tell so much about dinosaurs eating, mating, muscles, etc., just from their bones?
That's a good question. I'm going to pass on the mating one. I don't.
That's all projection. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Somebody else in a related question says, I know this is not so common a question, but I am interested. How did dinosaurs mate? So a couple of people have brought it up, but you can pass. It's fine.
Well, they're just like birds.
Maybe they were just like birds. Just think of birds.
Think of birds.
Successfully.
Right. I have no
they
idea
made
how birds
it,
mate, to be honest.
They successfully until it was over.
Successfully is all you need to say. That's right.
What were the other three aspects from the bone?
Of their eating, their muscles, etc., just from their bones.
Okay. Well, from their bones, we can certainly tell their comparative musculature because where muscles attach on the skeleton, they leave what's called a scar. There may be a ridge of bone or bone that has a different texture. Mm-hmm. And in order to figure out which muscles they were, students and paleontologists do a lot of dissections of modern animals. Mm-hmm. And every time, you know, in years past, if something died at the zoo, we'd love to get our hands on it. as the students do. But, you know, really one of the basic classes you take as a vertebrate paleontologist is comparative vertebrate morphology.
Yep.
And many of our graduate students in the paleontology program at Berkeley teach human anatomy because you need to become familiar with the muscles and which ones they are. And this gives you, by looking at the bones, we can tell what their soft tissue anatomy might have been like. And then that plays a role getting into functional morphology.
Right. So determining how fast T-Rex could run by figuring out the length of the bone, the size of the bone scar. I mean, will that give you an idea how big the muscles are and then how much force? Like, can you do all those calculations?
One can, and we had a graduate student a few years back do that. And then if you have a trackway that you can put that skeleton in to ground truth your model, that's not always possible. As far as what dinosaurs ate, we can look at their teeth to sort of, at least in a general sense, narrow that down. Plant eaters have batteries of hundreds, if not thousands, of teeth, like Triceratops or Hadrosaurs or duck-billed dinosaurs. They have these columnar teeth that have a very distinctive wear facet, and we can see where what we call the occlusal surfaces, where the jaws, how they move, and the wear pattern of the teeth reflects that. Some cases we find, you know, metasequoia needles and equisetum, another, you know, sort of grassy plant, you know, in the stomach cavity of certain dinosaurs. But minimally, we find a lot of plant fossils in these, in and around these localities, so we can get an idea of exactly what they were eating. And you can look at dinosaur poop. So to even give you a clearer idea of what they were eating. So
that explains all the coprolites around my house when I was a kid growing up.
That's right. It was all about science. All in the name of science.
Right. Well, some people have made their careers on a good part of their career looking at dinosaur coprolites. But again, I mean, it's important if you're trying to, just like, you know, if we've sunk one-third of dinosaur species, or at least one-third of dome-headed species, if we've done that, we're altering what we think of as the paleo community at that time and the community dynamics. And then you can look at the plants to see what they were eating. And then you can look at the carnivores with their teeth that look like, you know, like on a T-Rex, like an 8-inch banana with a serrated edge. You can hypothesize and talk about who they were eating and what were the population dynamics to support the community that we're finding as we do our field work. And we're working on that very question right now in another study.
Yeah, it sounds like a lot of detective work. So going from pieces of information that you know and then kind of putting them together according to ecological principles, environmental principles, and physiological principles that we know from living organisms and living environments, and kind of taking it back.
You're absolutely right. And any questions we ask have to be grounded in both an evolutionary context as well as a functional context. And I mean, I can wave my arms and tell you what I think dinosaurs did or didn't do, but you need evidence to support these ideas.
Dinosaurs breathed fire. And no, probably didn't happen.
Probably not.
Something that we talked about earlier, so that birds are related to dinosaurs. Somebody, Penguin 6, asks about a theory that dinosaurs did not die from an asteroid. Is there still a lot of conversation about whether it was a giant asteroid bombardment that killed off dinosaurs, or whether it was just swine flu? Yeah.
There's a lot of discussion, continued discussion, about that extinction, just as there is about, you know, the end Permian extinction. I mean, extinction is not a unique event to the end of the age of dinosaurs. Certainly above a certain level in the rocks, we don't find any more dinosaur bones. But a lot of animals went right across that boundary. And it's difficult, it's challenging to pick up on what the species diversity was up to at and cr- crossing that particular boundary in the rock record. And a lot of scientists spend a significant part of their field seasons and careers looking at that rock record worldwide. Now, is there evidence that a large asteroid occurred? Absolutely. Was it the sole factor for the extinction of the dinosaurs? I don't think so. There was a lot of changes going on in the world at that time. You had the evolution of flowering plants. You had changing climates. Maybe dinosaur diversity was on its way out, you know, towards that boundary. I mean, it probably didn't help them very much. But, you know, the question is, what's the resolution? What hypotheses can we adequately test? Because we may not have the resolution to do so.
I have a question from an old college friend, actually, Casey Murphy, who commented and said, T-Rex versus an alien from the Alien movies, who wins?
T-Rex versus alien. Well, my cultural knowledge here is going to be tested a bit. I just saw Alien 2, though. So Sigourney Weaver did a good job, but I didn't see the.
I think that alien was pretty badass. I think that's going to be a tough fight.
Tough alien. I think the aliens are pretty tough. I don't know.
Ginger or T-Rex? I think T-Rex wins. I'm just kidding. I'm just making it up. I'm sorry. Ignore me, please.
But it is interesting to see in these movies when they do show the skeletons of. The skeleton of something like Alien or you know, these monsters in the movie and the retractable jaws and the teeth and the, you know, where they get their sort of anatomical inspiration from. I think they do get it in large part from dinosaurs.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure, yeah. I mean, we think of dinosaurs as monsters, but of course they weren't necessarily.
Well, I grew up, I mean, I think the what we know about T-Rex has changed since I was little, but... When I grew up, T-Rex was a beast to be feared.
Well, Godzilla, you know.
Even like, with the little arms.
Yeah. That made it all the more creepy.
I know. Little arms, little hands.
I remember reading all sorts of... In fact, I remember the big mural at the Yale Museum of Paleontology, which they had to update to reflect changed theories of dinosaurs. And for a while, wasn't there kind of a thought that dinosaurs were much more colorful than we had thought, maybe even had feathers? Where does that stand?
Well, dinosaurs did have feathers, or do have feathers.
They still do.
They still do.
They still do. The fossil record, particularly from China, has supported that significantly in the last 10 or 12 years now. There are a number of dinosaur specimens that show feather preservation. And that was long ago predicted with, you know, I mean, really the difference between Archaeopteryx and a dinosaur like... Sloarosaurus was the fact that Archaeopteryx had feathers. So it was predicted that we would find dinosaurs one day. Oh,
interesting.
And we have. And I suspect dinosaurs were very colorful. And that would be one way of distinguishing males from females, just like birds do today.
Yeah.
And we have evidence that their bones of their skull, for instance, with these vessel grooves, these large incised channels that house blood vessels also supported a covering of hard skin. And it's been shown in birds like toucans and cassowaries and assateets that it's very easy to color using the structural collagen to emit light in different spectra. So I suspect dinosaurs were very colorful. They might have been colorful seasonally or upon maturity, for instance. And I think that's why even with Triceratops, why the horns went from, you know, in the younger individuals curving backwards to this extreme change in direction where they recurve forward. They had this expression of all these bumps and knobs and horns on their faces and ornamental bones around the margin of their frill and such. And I would hypothesize that they were, in fact, very, very colorful.
What got you interested in dinosaurs in the first place? I mean, now you've got a job where you're surrounded as one of the directors of the Museum of Paleontology. You've got you've got bones all around you. You're surrounded. I mean, are you? It's got to be in your happy place right now.
Never heard it quite described that way. But yeah, I love coming to work every day. I have for, you know, for my whole tenure at Berkeley. 1964 World's Fair. Seeing the reconstructions of Tyrannosaurus and Stegosaurus by the Rush Studios, I believe, from Chicago. Mm. And if you ever fly into JFK and you drive into Manhattan, you still go through Flushing Meadows where the Unisphere is.
The globe.
Globe and Men in Black film there with the towers. But yeah, that was, I think that really turned me on to dinosaurs. There was a science museum I visited quite a bit outside of Boston. And then, of course, you know, going to the American Museum of Natural History in New York.
I was brought up there practically every Saturday. I would go there in a stroller. And I remember very well that World's Fair in 64, although what I saw was video phones. So I think we took different paths in life.
Yeah,
it seems Mark, like, because I saw the video phones and you saw the dinosaurs. Isn't that funny?
Yeah, so that had a lot to do with it. Plus, I had some influential teachers and mentors along the way. And I always did sort of early on did different things in paleontology. And, you know, I always liked traveling, being outdoors and not wearing a tie and jacket to work every day.
Right, exactly. Getting to go outside, doing your summer field work, which is not necessarily a bad season to be doing field work. Unless you're in maybe the Sahara Desert or something, but and then also having time and having the flexibility to be able to study what you're interested in. So you're studying and you're focused on dinosaurs, but you still have the time to do the research that you want to do. And what would you say would be the best places around? I guess the Bay Area are the best places to take kids to go check out dinosaurs. Is the UC Museum of Paleontology, is that open to the public? And is it something that you would suggest for parents to bring their kids to?
Well, for your listeners, April 17th is Cal Day on campus. And the UC Museum of Paleontology, which is in the Valley Life Sciences building, will have hands-on activities for kids. They can pick little microvertebrate fossils, bones and teeth of dinosaurs and mammals and turtles and turtle bones and crocodiles and fish under a microscope. That's a great day to bring kids and families to campus. We're in a public building. We have exhibits in the public building. We have, and you can find out more about it on our website. And I would encourage kids. And we have a lot of content on an award-winning website.
And that's ucmp.berkeley.edu?
That's correct.
Great.
And it's updated regularly. We're linked into the social networking sites with Facebook and with Twitter, and there's the site from the homepage. And I encourage people to check this out. And also, if you come to the Valley Life Sciences building, it's open during business hours, as they say, on campus. There's a Tyrannosaurus skeleton. I think it's one of the few T-Rex skeletons you can get right up next to.
Oh, that's neat.
Very cool.
Very appreciation for the size. You can see an adult triceratops and a baby and a juvenile skull, a teenager in the lobby of the foyer of the biosciences library, but please keep your voices down in there. we have an ichthyosaur, a marine reptile from, was actually traded for fossils from the Rancho La Brea from the tar pits back in like the early 1900s. So it's been an early resident of UC Berkeley, and we put that on exhibit this summer. We have a number of fossils on exhibit, but supplemented with content and information and for both teachers and educators as well as students of all ages about evolutionary biology, evolution, science in general, and paleontology in general. And I talk a lot about dinosaurs because that's what I study, but UCMP is much more than just dinosaurs. And our collections, we have one of the largest collections of fossils associated with any university in the world. Mm-hmm. We have invertebrate fossils, clams and snails. We have a vast fossil plant collection, a micropaleo microfossil collection, in addition to vertebrates, and a lot of photographs and information is linked to our website. So I would encourage your listeners to check that out as well.
Yeah, it sounds like a wonderful resource of information. It sounds great. Well, I thank you very much for joining us today. This has been lots of fun. I love the finding out more about dinosaurs with every day that paleontology keeps looking into the past. There's always more to find out, and you think you're right, and then you find out you were wrong. And I just thank you so much for joining us and spending the time to talk with us about that today.
Thanks, I enjoyed it. Thanks for the invitation. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Great fun. Really interesting.
Yeah. So Dr. Mark Goodwin has been our guest today. He's an assistant director at the UC Museum of Paleontology, and you can visit the website ucmp.berkeley.edu to find out more information about the museum and to check out a lot of the photos and other links and educational resources, which we love a lot. And I guess that's about it for us today. This has been Dr. Kiki Science Hour, and we'll be back here next week to talk about making evolution-proof drugs with Dr. Andrew Reed. It'll be interesting. Yes. How do you battle bacteria? How do you battle the forces of evolution when all we've got is science? That's all we've got. You can find me online on Twitter at Dr. Kiki, DrKiki. My website is drkiki.tv. And you can download Dr. Kiki's Science Hour from iTunes. It's also on the Twit website, twit.tv/Kiki, if you'd like to find past episodes. This episode will be up in a couple of days, so thanks for listening now, and you can listen again later.
See you next time.
See you next time.